Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry's on vacation up in Door County. You might find him on snowshoes today up around the Peninsula State Park, and if you do, be sure and say hello. And for Garden Talk today, we have Laura Jell, who's an associate professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. Laura, it's a pleasure to see you today.
Good morning.
And, of course, Brian Huddleston, plant disease diagnostician with the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, UW-Madison Extension. Brian, great to see you as well.
Thank you for having me.
So if you have questions about woody ornamentals and about plant diseases, this is the program. We will not be talking about other things, but we will talk about woody ornamentals, and let's define them for the listening audience, Laura.
Woody ornamentals are traditionally trees, shrubs, evergreens, woody vines, and woody ground covers, anything that has secondary growth, meaning that it comes back every year, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
Brian probably doesn't want it to.
I do love my diseases, but I'd rather have stuff survive the winter.
And in terms of diseases, anything that befalls plants is in your domain, is
basically,
it, Brian?
Basically, the only crop I don't work with is turf. We have a separate turf diagnostic facility here on campus, and I do everything else, though. So that can be woody ornamentals, it can be herbaceous ornamentals, it can be field crops, basically anything.
Mm-hmm. Mother Nature is certainly taking her revenge because what looked to be spring approaching is now we're back with winter. What has this winter done in terms of any damage, in terms of these ornamental trees, shrubs, vines?
That's a good question. Actually, snow is a fabulous insulator. And so for things that were buried underneath the snow, potentially they have increased survivability because of the insulating effect of the snow. However, the weight of the snow, we've had tremendous snowfall here in Madison area. In fact, probably after today's snowstorm, we'll probably hit 100 inches this year, which is unbelievable. The weight of the snow can break branches. It can crush things. I've seen a lot of snow injury, breaking of branches and so on. Particularly this year, what I've seen the most of is animal damage. I've seen tremendous vole and rabbit injury on woody plants. And the voles are underneath the snow. They actually, it's like a mouse, but it has different type of incisor teeth, and it gets in there and it chews the bark off the base of the of certain plants that it prefers. Same with rabbits, on the other hand, are on top of the snow, and I've seen damage, 4 feet high this year. They get on their back legs and they get up and they chew on the, they actually have a nice clean cut to the twigs, and you'll see, looks like a paper shredder that went through the plant, or the plant went through a paper shredder. Other types of injury, most of the trees are fine, but I'm seeing also snowplow injury, mm-hmm. where snowplows went through and they hit a tree or they scuffed up the bark. I've seen a lot of that, or just smashing of plants from the snow weight.
All right. If people would like to join the conversation with comments and questions, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Just before we go to the phones, Brian, let's talk about how someone can make use of the diagnostics clinic. What do they have to do?
Basically, observe a diseased plant, something that doesn't look normal, and you can take a sample of that plant. If it can be a leaf, it can be an entire plant. If you're dealing with, say, with a cluster of plants where you can sacrifice a whole plant, we like to see whole plants, actually, mm-hmm. when we can. you can submit that sample through your county extension office, and they can forward it on to my office, or you can send it directly to my clinic, and we do have a website where you can find our submission form and instructions on how to package up the sample and send it in. And that website is P as in Paul, D as in David again, C as in Charles, dot WISC, short for Wisconsin, dot EDU, short for education. And there's no www on the front, just start with the PDDC.
PDDC.WISC.EDU.
Yes, indeed.
Minimal charge?
$15 to $20 for most samples. Some things are slightly more expensive, but most samples we can do for $15 to $20.
And you'll find that on the website. All right, let's go to the phones, take some calls. We'll start with Janet in Madison. Hello, Janet. What's on your mind today?
Hello. Well, I planted 4 native Canadian hemlocks about 5 years ago, and they did very, very well, and now they're 4 or 5 feet tall. Well, 2 of them this spring are dead. The top two-thirds are just dead. And I've looked for insect damage. I can't see anything. And I'm wondering what could have happened over this winter to injure my hemlocks.
Did you look at the base of the plant to see for chewing or gnawing marks at the base of the plant?
No, I didn't. I was just thinking because the base needles are so green and alive that that wouldn't be a problem, but maybe I should.
Okay, that's one possibility. The other possibility, where did you plant your hemlock?
Well, I have a back property line, and I'm trying to create a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have some arborvitae there now that are doing fabulously. One of the things I was wondering, if it's possibly too wet.
That's what I was getting to. Hemlocks are very sensitive to drainage. They need good drainage, though. They need a moist soil. They're very intolerant to drought. Hemlocks also are prone to winter burn, and that's where the foliage desiccates or dries out over the winter, particularly the side that's facing the western and northwestern and southwestern winds, as well as the winter sun. They actually are preferred to be in the shade or partial shade. You can plant them out in the sun, but they need to be in a protected location because they do, are subject to winter burn.
So there could be some, would that be like wind damage? Or?
Well, it is wind damage, but it's not breaking of branches per se. It's the side of the plant facing the oncoming winds as well as the sun. That side of the plant will show browning of needles, and it look desiccated or dried out. You'll have dieback, especially since you said the bottom part of the plant looked fine. That was underneath the snow, and the top part of the plant was out in the open.
Right.
That almost sounds like it might be winter burn or winter injury. They're perfectly hardy here. They're native, but they really need to be put in a protected location because of the winter burn problem. If you put it on the east side of a building, they'll do fine. But out in the open, they are subject to winter burn.
Well, that's a good possibility. Thank you so much.
Janet, sure. Thank you very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. Norman is next in Wausau. Norman, what can we do for you?
I have two questions. One is probably for Brian. One is on my citrus trees. I've got a number of them inside, and I'm having a real struggle to keep them going during the wintertime. The leaves fall off, and they get yellow or light green between the veins. I don't know if it's my soil. I've tried to redo that by using a combination of sand and potting soil, and I even used some vermiculite to give it better aeration. I'm just not sure what the problem is. I have fluorescent lights over them for in the evening and early in the evening. So I'm not sure what's going on with those.
Yeah, my first thought is that it may be some sort of environmental issue. In particular, Laura was mentioning to me here as we were listening to you that possibly some light issues, although you do have them under fluorescent lights, that's certainly going to help. But keep in mind that these are tropical plants and tend to have higher light requirements. The other thing is if you're seeing a lot of weird yellowing, you mentioned kind of a pattern of yellowing on the leaves. Are the veins still green?
The veins are green, mm-hmm. but in between it's light green, especially on the new leaves, and then on the older ones it kind of turns more yellow, and sometimes then they drop off.
Yeah, oftentimes that's a fertility issue, and the nutrient that I would be most curious about would be iron or manganese, one of those two, and you need to kind of figure out exactly which one is the problem. So what you might want to consider doing is taking some of those yellowish leaves, send them into our soil and plant analysis lab. They can do a nutrient test on the tissue for you, and then they can let you know what nutrients are missing in the leaf tissue. We see this sort of pattern of leaf discoloration where you have kind of yellowish leaves but very dark green veins, oftentimes on things like oaks outdoors, and also on red maples very commonly have this particular problem. On oaks, the typical problem is an iron deficiency, and it's usually pH-induced, where our soils here in Wisconsin are overly high, so we tend to have problems with iron availability to the plants. And then on red maples, I believe it's a manganese. Correct me if I'm wrong, Laura, but it's usually manganese that's the issue on that particular plant. And I suspect you're running into the same sort of problem just on an indoor plant. So you need to get a sense of what the nutrient is that's missing, and then you can increase fertilizing with that particular nutrient to hopefully help yourself out. And that'll help you maintain some of the leaves as well, because I'm sure some of the leaf loss that you're seeing is just kind of the end result of those nutrient deficiencies.
I also wanted to add one thing. The pH of our tap water is exceptionally high, and that will cause the pH in the soil to rise over time. Even though you may have a very organic type of potting mix with a lot of peat moss, which is helpful, but our pH of our water is really high. And I remember from my days doing interior plant maintenance with citrus, they're very prone to chlorosis, where the leaves turn yellow and the veins remain green. And it was a water issue. And we actually, in interior plant maintenance, we had to treat our water to make it more acidic. And in a homeowner environment, it's very difficult to do that. You can use bottled water or distilled water or something that doesn't come from our tap, because we have a lot of bicarbonates in our water.
How about a little vinegar in water, melted snow or rainwater?
Rainwater is good. I wouldn't bother with a vinegar.
Yeah. Do you have a dehumidifier in your house by any chance?
No, we're trying to humidify it.
Oh, okay. Because some people have dehumidifiers, and oftentimes that water is quite useful for using for watering plants.
And then the second question was on my blueberries. Ever since I put sawdust on them about 3 years ago, about 3-4 inches, and I did add extra nitrogen, I've really had a problem. A lot of them have died on me, and the ones that are growing, they don't seem to want to produce many new shoots, and the tips of the leaves are brown and not looking good, and they die back, the new shoots, that is. And I did do something unusual in that I put a perforated plastic, like a bucket under them, in the ground in order to keep some of the water and the soil I put in, which was a lot of peat moss, with the plant, and they were doing reasonably good for a number of years. But when I put the sawdust in, I don't know, I think maybe I got them too wet and they got root rot, because the ones that didn't look good, when I dug them up, the roots were either all dead or nearly all dead. In other words, as you cut through the cross section, you could see part of it was still alive and part of it was dead. I'm talking about the big roots, like
right.
Half inch or so.
You mentioned sawdust. Is that what you said you added?
Right.
Okay, that's one of the worst things you can add. Sawdust can get very hot. It's not composted, and it has a very high carbon to nitrogen ratio, meaning that the microbes in the soil will actually take nitrogen away from the plant and use it to break down the sawdust. Sawdust should never be used around plants. It's not good at all. It also retains too much moisture. And with blueberries, they actually prefer a very acidic, sandy, peat kind of type soil, very well drained. And putting a bucket underneath them is also not good, because you probably just, unfortunately, created like a bathtub effect. Water wasn't able to drain away from the plants, and they are very susceptible to root rot.
Yeah, I suspect Phytophthora root rot, which is a soil-borne fungus-like organism that's very common on that particular host. So, but I think you probably could have avoided those problems by having the soil a little better drained. Root rots, typically we see an increase in root rot problems when the soil is very, very wet.
Well, good luck to you, Norman. That's some advice to follow, and we appreciate hearing from you. Our guest today, Laura Jell, who is an associate professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. Brian Huddleston is in the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, UW-Madison and Extension. I'm Jim Packard. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk. Glad to have you with us today. The number for you to get to the program in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to the phones to John in Berlin. Hello, John.
Hi. When your guest spoke about the vole damage, the melting snow did reveal lots on the lawn. But to my horror, I have about a 14-year-old apple tree, which is probably 60 to 70% girdled. And I was absolutely horrified as a snow melted to see this. Is there anything that I can do to help the survivability or give it a chance?
Well, that's a good question. We will find out. It probably will. You said 60 to 70%. That's pretty bad.
Yeah, it's over 50%.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. It was like a foot, actually, from, you know, where the stuff started to the, on one side of it. It's like, oh, my gosh, I was absolutely amazed.
Yeah, they were hungry this year. Actually, with the remaining part that's still connected, that's not girdled at all, you know, obviously leave that alone. If you have any mulch near the base of the plant, get rid of it. Mulch should never touch the base of trees or shrubs because that's a perfect place for voles to hide from predators. And then they get hungry and they just pop their head out and start chewing. Also, by having too much mulch around the base of the plant, it can also lead to basal rot and other problems occurring on the apple tree. The remaining part that is girdled, I would leave it alone. Do not put any wound compound or tree paint or anything like that. That's been proven in research that actually slows down wound closure, and it actually retains too much moisture underneath, causing further decay. The plant, it's going to try to close its wounds, that area that the vole girdled. It'll take years, considering how big it is. The plant may or may not survive. I would just wait and see, water it, make sure it's well watered, because obviously the area that's, you know, the plant had been girdled, there's not much water transport in that side of the tree. I don't know how deep it is. There can be second year, previous year xylem that may still be conducting water that may help, but I would baby this plant, make sure it's well watered, during summertime, so it's not suffering from drought stress. And
do I want to prune it back?
No.
No, okay.
No.
And try to keep that wounded area as dry as possible, because what you want to do is, if you have a real moist wound like that, it provides a real nice entry point for a variety of different fungal pathogens that, if the girdling from the animals doesn't kill it off, the fungus will.
Okay.
So try to keep that on the dry side as much as possible.
Okay. Then would it be advisable to spray it with a fungicide periodically, or
no? It's the best thing to do is make it a very unattractive environment for the fungal pathogens that are out there, and basically that means keeping it dry.
Thank you.
All right, John. Good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. Again, the number for you in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. As we talk with Laura Gell about trees, shrubs, and vines, and with Brian Huddleston about plant disease diagnostics. We go to Holly next in Baraboo. Hello, Holly.
Hello. My question is my Chinese wisteria. I cannot get her to bloom. This will be her fifth summer. What is going on with her?
Are you sure it's Chinese wisteria and not one of the other wisterias?
I ordered Chinese wisteria.
Okay,
hopefully that's what I have.
Because Chinese wisteria is not hardy here.
It isn't.
Nope.
I bought it out of a nursery in Minnesota.
That's surprising. The wisteria that we can grow here is called the Kentucky wisteria. It's
really?
Wisteria macrostax. It's a North American native.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese, as well as the Japanese wisteria, Wisteria sinensis, as well as Wisteria floribunda, those are not hardy here. The flower buds will be killed in winter.
Well, she grows crazy. She just bloomed for me.
Yeah, the vegetative buds are often five, if not more, degrees cold hardy than vegetative buds. So it may leaf out just fine. But the flower buds may be killed. The other thing is are you pruning it at all?
No.
Okay. I know with the Kentucky wisteria, to get it to flower, we suggest pruning it back pretty hard every year, meaning you wouldn't cut the whole vine back, but the main stem of the vine you would leave intact, but the side branches, you would cut them back to within about three buds from the main stem. So if a side branch is, say, 10 inches long, prune it back to where you only see about three buds.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd prune it back, say, 7 inches out of 10, if not more. And that actually can help the plant switch from a vegetative mode to more of a flower mode. I'd watch your fertilizer as well, because wisteria, if you over-fertilize with nitrogen, they will not flower at all. But yeah, if it's the true Chinese wisteria, it's not flower bud hardy here.
All right. Thank you.
All right, Holly. Good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. On to Bill in De Pere. Hi, Bill. What's on your mind?
Yeah. Hi. Thank you. I have a Korean lilac. It's probably about 8 years old, maybe 3 inches in diameter. Doing very well until late last summer when several branches suddenly died.
Ooh.
Kind of wondering, you know, what's going to happen in the spring, what's happening in general, and what should I do about it?
Yeah, I always hate when I hear someone describe this particular scenario because my first thought is, being the awful disease person that I am, is that it's probably a disease called verticillium wilt. Lilacs certainly are susceptible to that. This particular disease can affect a variety of woody ornamentals and also some herbaceous plants as well. But the typical symptom that you see is what we call a sectional dieback. So you'll see exactly what you described. The shrub looks great, and then all of a sudden a couple of branches will start to wilt and die back. And unfortunately, this fungus is in the soil, comes in through the root system, and gets into the water-conducting tissue and plugs it up. And that's why those particular branches wilt. And unfortunately, the fungus will eventually colonize the entire shrub, and it will most likely die. About the only thing you can really do to try to prolong the life of the shrub is to you can prune out those dead branches. You're really not removing the fungus because it's going to be elsewhere in the shrub. Make sure it's getting adequate water. Make sure that its fertility is good, and just try to baby it to keep it as happy as possible until it eventually dies. And oftentimes you can delay, at least for a little while, the final, you know, stages of the disease where the entire shrub.
But it'd be just as well off to take it out and get a successor, right?
Yeah, you certainly could do that, although it's not necessary. You could certainly, if the shrub looks reasonable to you at this point, you're getting good flowering, it looks aesthetically pleasing to you, you could certainly keep it around for a while until it does start to look a little bit on the shabby side. And then what you would need to do is be very careful about a replacement. And we actually do have a fact sheet on this particular disease where we give you some suggestions on alternative trees and shrubs that you could potentially plant in that area. And that particular fact sheet is available at the UW Extension Horticulture website, which is wihort.uwex.edu. Click on University Garden Facts in the main menu, and then in the disease column, just look for verticillium wilt. It'll be down towards the bottom of the first column.
Okay. One other question. The man with the girdled apple tree, could he consider bridge grafting?
Yes, he could. Yes, he could. It's pretty. If he doesn't know how to do it, there are books out there on grafting. Bridge grafting is where you are taking seedlings, typically of apple, and you're planting them around the base of the tree, and then you're doing a type of graft where you're then grafting into the side or the bottom of the plant around the girdled area, and basically those new seedlings that or liners that you planted around the apple tree become the new root system. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Could you use suckers for that if the tree had them?
Yeah, he could. Sure.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, Bill. Thanks very much. We appreciate that. Mike in South Shore has got some advice, I believe, on girdling. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I was just going to, again, comment on this bridge grafting. If this is an important apple tree that this gentleman has, I'd get somebody local here. I wouldn't monkey around himself
right,
trying this, but I'd get a local, somebody who has maybe has an orchard that does some grafting, has some experience, and get somebody in there to do that. That's the way to save this tree. Since it happened this year, but I'd get on it right now before too long. I think the key is to get this done early.
Yeah, I would recommend getting an expert in there. Like, I didn't mention it purposely because it's very hard to describe to people over the radio on how to properly do it, and it is tricky. And getting the cambium lined up just right is also a key.
He couldn't do this
no,
the first time.
Absolutely not.
Somebody in there, but if it's an important tree, I get somebody in there to do it.
Right,
Mike. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your advice. And on to Chet in Athens. Chet's got more advice. Hi.
Well, I have kind of a strange story. I have 2 30-foot box elders that are weed trees in my fence row. And a couple of years ago, I decided I was going to get rid of them the way the early settlers did by girdling around about a foot of bark. I removed all the bark on both these trees, and that was in early spring 2 years ago. Interesting enough, the tree foliaged out as normal that summer. Last year, it suddenly stopped setting seed, but it still set foliage out. So sometimes, as your guest had stated, that sometimes this cambium layer might still be bringing moisture or food, I guess, up to the rest of the tree. And maybe that person with that apple tree might find that that it'll get enough nourishment and so forth.
Yeah. Some species, their previous year's xylem is still conducting. Some tree species, the xylem may be conducting for up to 3-4 years before it eventually becomes non-conducting anymore. So even though if a tree is girdled, certain species, that is, if the species is girdled, the underlying xylems, 2- and 3-year-old xylem, may still be conducting. But the phloem is not, obviously, because you've removed the phloem. Carbohydrates are not being conducted back down or translocated back down to the root system, only on the side of the tree to those roots that are fully connected.
May I just say one other thing?
What would that be, Chet?
This reminds me of these people that are buying these Christmas trees and trying to transplant them. The unscrupulous landscaper will have this tree. They'll guarantee it 1 year, and, of course, the tree will not turn brown or anything because you could be almost assured that it'll stay green for 1 year. But if you drive around the countryside and see these sad-looking Christmas trees that were transplanted, especially winters where it's severe wind, they just will not make it. So people should always buy from a registered nursery, not from some of these fly-by-night operators.
Are you talking Christmas trees, planting them that have no roots attached?
No. Christmas trees that are grown
live.
Okay.
We understand, Chet. We understand.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks very much. We appreciate that. Did you want to add something to that?
No, I actually, in transplanting evergreens, the best time of year to plant them is actually spring through about September. Evergreens should never be transplanted in late fall. I've seen some evergreens, even junipers that are tough as nails, planted in November, and they were dead as a doornail come spring. They do not sufficiently flush a new root system before the ground freezes and are very subject to drying out and desiccation, so they really should not be planted, say, after October 1st or so, depending on where you are in the state.
Our guests are Laura Gell, who is an associate professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals, and Brian Huddleston is a plant disease diagnostician with the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic at the UW-Madison. And we move on to Jim in Wausau next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I got trouble growing shagbark hickory trees. They don't leaf out for me the last 3 or 4 years, so they don't seem like they have much of a root system. I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with them. So, are they easy-going tree or not?
Are these newly planted trees?
They would be 1 or 2 years old. You know, I try to plant them in the spring, you know, shagbark hickories.
Yeah. Shagbark hickory is a native tree. It's perfectly... Where are you located?
North of Stevens Point a little bit.
Okay. I'm pretty sure they're hardy up there. Yeah, they are hardy up there. One thing with the nut species, oaks, hickories, walnuts, the first couple years after you transplant them, they just sit there. They don't do much.
Yeah, these only leaf out. I don't get leaves at all. So
yeah, actually, there's a technique called sweating, and it's recommended to use on bare root material. You're actually, before you even plant them, you get them in spring, and you basically put them in a very moist, humid environment, not wet. But what you're trying to do is get bud swell on those buds. And you do that for about a week at about 60-degree temperature. And you can do that in moist packing material. You can do that underneath plastic with other moist material underneath it. Make sure you keep the roots moist. If the roots dry out at all, your tree is dead. And then plant them in May. And as soon as the temperature gets, beyond a freeze, And then keep them well watered, and they should leaf out. I've seen this on a number of oak species, bur oak in particular, where cities planted a bunch of bur oaks and they never leafed out. And that sweating of the nursery stock is really important before time of planting to get enough moisture in those bud tissues before they can fully leaf out.
Would you prune the root system at all, though, better?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
Yeah, what kind of soil do you have in your area?
Sandy loam.
Yeah, it's sandy up there. Any issues with water, perhaps?
Yeah, I watered almost, it was so hot, I watered almost every day, almost a little bit, so I don't know. What about other hickory trees? Are there other ones that are easier to grow or not?
Other hickories in particular? One of my favorite hickories is called bitter nut hickory. And that's called Caria cordiformis. That's a native to Wisconsin species. It's more in the southern part of the state. I'm not sure if it would be hardy up there. But it's got phenomenal fall color, very bright yellow fall color. But you would transplant it the same way as you would another hickory.
Okay.
All right, Jim.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks very much. We appreciate your call. And on to Paul in Boscobel. Hi, Paul.
Howdy. I'm here.
Yep.
There was a gentleman earlier that talked about he had an apple tree that was girdled around.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to tell him this, but I've bridge grafted such things, and though the bridge grafts will work at first, but eventually all the stresses of it trying to grow in that bowed position, they'll pop out on you, and so it's not a very successful way to go. Really?
It can be if you know what you're doing. A lot of orchards have done this technique with great success.
The ones I've seen that they usually just start, especially with the trees nowadays, the smaller ones that start into fruiting so early, they usually just replant.
That would be one option available to us. Paul, thanks very much. We appreciate your advice on that. And on to Michael in New Berlin. Hello, Michael.
Hello. My wife and I have a home and we have an evergreen. She believes it's a red pine, and last winter the needles turned brown. It seemed to recover in the summer, and the needles have turned brown again this year. It's probably between 50 and 60 years old, and we're wondering if it's just past its prime or if the other. There's the one that's similar in age, similar in size, that's nearby that seems to be doing fine, but this one is not looking very healthy.
First of all, where are you located in the state?
New Berlin, Wisconsin.
Oh, no, New Berlin. Okay. Are you sure it's a red pine?
I really don't know. That's what she thought it was. Usually we have whites and red pines
okay.
in Wisconsin.
Well, red pine and white pine are native. So this is a native area?
We believe so.
Okay. Red pine, like white pine, needs excellent drainage. They're very intolerant to poorly drained wet soils. They also, especially with red pine, they like it acidic as well.
Right. We have heavy clay soil, and it's right next to the, it's above the ditch for a higher fill, but it's near the ditch, and it had been healthy for a long, long time. It's like the last couple of winters, it changed.
Was there any fill placed around the base of the tree?
No.
Okay.
Any drought-stressed issues? I mean, when I start to see browning needles, my first thought is always, and the sort of recovery that you're talking about, is that there may be drought stress issues. It's been relatively dry in Wisconsin over the past several years, and so that may be a contributing factor. The other thing that sometimes will cause needle tip browning would be salt, I suppose, injury. If there's any source of salt, road salt or something like that in the vicinity of the tree, that could be contributing as well.
That is possible. It is closer to the road than its partner that's of similar size and age. So,
how far from the road would it be?
That's looking at it right now, it's probably 7 to 8 feet from the edge of the road.
You say that it does seem to re-needle, though, and the needles look green at least for a while. Is that correct?
Right. It did last summer. It looked bad in the winter, and the summer it's turned green again.
Yeah, I'm having a sort of feeling on my end that it may be some water stress issues on that particular tree. And if the tree's going under a lot of stress, then you need to worry about there's certain types of beetles that will come in and will start attacking the tree, and that can cause more serious problems and actually some more permanent dieback in the tree. So you need to be cautious that it's not going under too much stress.
Another thing is, have you noticed any type of sawdust on the bark of the tree, any sap pitch coming out of the tree? Are you noticing any small holes on the trunk of the tree?
Not recently, but we could look for that and see
okay.
if some insect damage.
I was thinking it might be Ips beetle or Zimmerman pine moth. That if they become stressed, they'll become susceptible to these insects.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for...
All right, Michael. Thank you very much for your call. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234 as we talk with Laura Jell about woody ornamentals and Brian Huddleston about plant disease. And we go next to Barney in Burlington. Hello, Barney. What's in your mind today?
Hi. Thank you. Two little things here, if you don't mind. My red and pine and spruce trees in early June, like when the delicate terminal growth is coming out, the crows come sit on and break it off, so then I wind up with a multiple tops there, which I put scarecrows out. Seems to help, but is there another solution? And also, if you don't mind, that girdling thing, I had something that worked 100% for me. The one time I tried it, I had a tree in the Upper Peninsula, a big apple tree, and something girdled it totally all the way around. So I cut a big branch off and stripped the bark off and laid it over the surface of the girdle and then cut through top and bottom because it overlapped on both ends with a sharp knife. I had it tacked down there with little tacks and things, and it grew perfect. It was didn't even know it was it's like taking a linoleum, like those people do, and lay pieces on top of another piece where they want the seam,
mm-hmm.
and they cut through both of them at the same time, and it just, you can't see the seam. That worked for me that one time. I only tried it once, but it was perfect, so that's possibly a solution, if you could mention.
All right.
A little something on
and the terminal growth on the spruce.
Yeah. Regarding the crow damage on the red pine, and there's really not much you can do about it unless you had a tree house and you hung out there all day to scare away the crows, which is highly unlikely, or hire a resident hawk to scare them away. There's not much you really can do.
Because they just break them terminal growth
yeah.
off,
yeah.
and you wind up, I've got maybe 5,000-6,000 trees out there.
Wow.
I don't like shooting at them. I mean, shooting,
no.
I shoot around them, which... They're pretty smart. They get the message for a few days there, but then I get soft-hearted in the winter and give them all these feed out there to suck them back in again. So
yeah.
My own fault, I guess. Thank you very much.
All right, Barney. Thank you very much for the call. And on to Linda in Oshkosh. Hi, Linda.
Hello. I have a question about a spruce tree.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Every year it would get less and less needles, and it would look more and more sparse. The new growth would come out nice and green in June, but every year it seemed to be a little bit less. And finally we chopped it down, thinking it looked really bad. And I never did find out if it was diseased. I wondered maybe it was just a problem with drought conditions, because it's growing in a clump of trees, on which one of them is a huge silver maple. I had a bad case of spider mites at 1 year, 2 years in a row. I don't know, now that we've chopped it down, can we use that material for mulch, or am I going to just be spreading disease?
There are a couple things that could be going on in terms of the reason why you were losing needles. Was it losing needles from the inside out?
Yes, I would have to say so.
Yeah, part of that could have been the spider mite injury, because those will feed and cause some dehydration in the needles, and then if the tree goes under some water stress, oftentimes those injured needles will be dropped. The other disease that will cause that sort of pattern of needle dropping is something called Rhizosphera needle cast. Rhizosphera is a type of fungus. It infects the needles, and eventually there'll be enough colonization of those needles that they just become stressed and will drop off the tree. And you can actually, if you've got any of those needles that fell off onto the ground, if you have any of those left, you can check to see whether it is this disease. It's actually a very easy one to diagnose on your own. I hate to say this, because I like to have these sorts of samples come into my lab, because they're very easy for us to do. We call them easy money diseases. But what you can do is take some of those needles, stick them, wrap them in a little bit of moistened paper toweling, and stick it in a plastic bag and seal it up for about 48 hours. And then pull those needles out and then take a magnifying glass, or sometimes you can even see this by eye, but if you look at the needles and start to see little rows of black dots on the needles, you're actually seeing this rhizosphera fungus popping up through the stomates, the little air exchange holes in the needles, and you'll see these little rows of what look like pepper spots on the needles, and that's how we diagnose the disease in our lab.
Okay.
It's a very common disease on spruce, particularly if it was a Colorado blue spruce. It's probably the major disease that we see. It's not lethal, but it kind of, as you described, you get so much needle loss that the tree isn't very attractive anymore, and it looks better cut down than left standing.
That's where we were at.
Yeah. I hate to say this. I love Colorado blue spruce, but unfortunately, it just doesn't do well in our climate around here. In terms of reusing the material, where were you planning on applying this chopped up? Are you going to chip the tree, or what were you going to do with it?
We were going to chip the tree, and mm-hmm. in the clump in the front yard where all the trees are growing, we're just going to spread it around in there.
Yeah, do you have other spruces in that area?
I have three balsams in that area, transplanted from northern Wisconsin.
A balsam firs?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then you probably wouldn't have too much of a problem. Oftentimes, I recommend composting this sort of material before you use it as a mulch. The heating process that you go through if you're doing proper composting will typically kill off most disease-causing organisms and plant material. So it's not outside the realm of possibility of using this for mulching material. You might want to be just a little bit careful with it. Although, quite frankly, if it's rhizosphera, rhizosphera is so common out in the environment that even if you didn't use it, there's going to be the fungus floating around, the spores of the fungus floating around in the air, and you could come up with the disease again. But I don't think it would be a bad thing to do. I think I would try to compost it a little bit before I use it.
Is it related to the apple scab? Because there's a crab apple in there.
Yeah, it's definitely different fungi. These are both fungal diseases, but it's radically different fungi that cause the two diseases. So, but they function in very similar ways. Rhizosphera tends to get established in areas of the tree where there's a lot of moisture. Apple scab tends to be more of a problem in trees with a lot of foliage where the leaves get wet. So they're different organisms, but the way the diseases kind of function are very similar.
Okay.
All right, Linda, thanks very much. Appreciate
it. We do have a fact sheet on both of those diseases
for
anyone who's interested at our wihort.uwex.edu website.
All right. And thanks, Linda, for your call. We'll take more calls in just a moment. Our guests are Laura Jull, who is an associate professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. Brian Huddleston's in the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, UW-Madison and Extension. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on this edition of Garden Talk as we talk about woody ornamentals and plant diseases. Our number in Madison, 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. And we move next to New Berlin and to Jill. Hello, Jill.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess it seems to be the day about questions for spruce and pine, but I had another question to add in. We have a row of pine along our lot line. I'm not sure what type they are, but they're about 15 feet tall and beautiful trees. And then one last year, basically little by little, got lighter and lighter in color until it was completely red. Eventually started dropping needles, but that wasn't really the problem early on. And we ended up cutting that one down, and now I notice that two more in the line of pines are starting to get that lighter color. And I was wondering if you could tell me what that might be. I noticed in a lot a couple miles down the road that there are a couple trees in that lot that look similarly affected. Was wondering if there's anything I can do to keep the other pines healthy.
When were these trees planted?
Well, they were full grown by the time we bought the house. I'm assuming they're probably about 8-9 years old.
Okay. It could be a water issue. That's one, you know, like Brian was saying, we've had a lot of drought stress the last couple of years. And then we had that horrible flood this past August.
Mm-hmm.
I know my basement flooded. But regarding the pines, you often, if you have a severe drought, which we did this summer, June and July were extraordinarily dry, and then we had flood damage. You have some root injury from the drought, some root death, and then you have a flood environment, and Brian...
And those lovely root rot fungi can get established, and the other thing I would worry about would be some of the insects that can potentially get in, the boring insects. Laura mentioned Zimmerman pine moth, and Ips beetle are two that will tend to come in on stressed trees. Are you seeing, you mentioned that you had one tree that was a problem, and then it's kind of moving to others. Is it kind of going down the line of the trees?
Is it
a tree here and a tree there?
It's the tree that was directly next to the one that was affected, but then it skips a tree, and then the tree after that is affected.
Yeah,
so.
One of the things I worry a little bit about when you start talking about trees in a row going down, there are certain soil-borne fungi that, particularly the one that I'm thinking of is one called Armillaria, which will tend to come on to trees that are under a little bit of stress. And this is a fungus that actually produces a mushroom, kind of a honey-colored mushroom, which you might want to check to see if you see it at the base of the dead tree. And once this fungus gets established, it kind of uses the tree that it's killed as a food base, and it sends out these little structures. They look kind of like shoestrings. They're called rhizomorphs, and they're kind of like little feelers. They kind of grow out, and when they reach another tree, then that structure can lead to the infection of a second tree. And oftentimes that pathogen, that fungus, will move down a row of trees and kill them off. So the things that I would look for, you kind of want to try to rule that one out, because that's a very nasty pathogen if you get it established, because it tends to have a fairly wide host range, and it might not only go to your pines but to other woody ornamentals in your area. So I'd watch for a couple of things, little kind of honey-colored mushrooms around the base of the tree, and you'll see those as we get into the wetter periods of the growing season. And then the other thing, if the bark is starting to loosen at the base of that dead tree, you might want to pull that off and see if you see kind of a whitish fan-shaped fungal structure underneath the bark. The fungus will actually form kind of a mat underneath the bark. It often kind of looks like a fan. And if you see that, you may want to get a sample in for us to just verify to see if you do have Armillaria. Usually if you have that, you need to be very careful about removing the trees, including the root system, as much of the root system as possible, because that particular fungus will colonize the tree. And again, as long as there's material that fungus can grow on, it'll use that as a food base to kind of look for other trees.
One thing I want to mention is, I know this sounds like a lot of work and you may or may not feel comfortable doing this. And if you don't, I highly suggest you contact a certified arborist. And I emphasize the word certified.
Yeah, I agree on this.
They're International Society of Arboriculture certified, ISA certified. And there's a number of them in the phone book. What city are you in?
New Berlin.
Yeah, there's tons. I can't recommend one, but there are
lots
a number of them
area.
In that area.
Yeah, very good ones.
And make sure they are ISA certified.
And have them come out and take a look at the trees. And oftentimes they may be able to see things that you don't pick up on. And it's always very difficult for us to try to figure out exactly what's going on from discussing things over the radio. So you need to have somebody who can come out, eyes, hands. And if they see something that's odd, they can collect a sample and then get something into my lab for analysis.
The Wisconsin Arborist Association has a wonderful website that has certified arborists for hire, and you can search by county. I don't have the exact web address.
www.waa-isa.org.
Thank you, Brian.
Yes, I refer people to that
one
all the time.
So waa-isa.org.
Yeah, with a www on the front.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good luck to you, Jill. Thank you very much. Appreciate hearing from you. Connie in Arcadia is next. Connie, what's on your mind today?
I have a question about a birch tree that's in our yard. It's maybe 50, 60 feet tall. It's been there quite a while. But it has four trunks, you know, coming from one base. And they lean out. And my husband's afraid the thing is going to split. So he's proposing to to cut it back a lot on the top to take some of the weight off of the trunks. And I'm wondering if that's a good idea. He he can do that. There's machinery around that he can do that, and I'm wondering, what do you think about that?
Okay, what kind of, do you know what kind of birch?
It's an old-fashioned birch from our woods.
So it's a white-barked birch?
Right.
Okay. And you said it had multiple branches coming from the base?
There's at least four, yeah.
Okay. A lot of times, and no, wait a minute, was this planted or is this natural?
No, it was planted. We moved it from the woods.
Yeah. Very often, birch trees, whether it's a river birch or a white-barked birch, they're sold as a clump form and from a nursery, and they often have multiple branches coming from the base of the tree, and they do that on purpose so that you have more, obviously, bark to look at, and it's very ornamental. I would not cut that tree back significantly. You will kill a tree if you remove more than one-third of the foliar tissue or branches at one time. You'll send that tree into a downward spiral, and it shouldn't split. A lot of times you'll see birches out in the woods, and they may have multiple clump-like forms. If there's a house nearby, or if you're parking your car near it, then that can be an issue. But when it comes to something like that, I don't recommend cutting the tree severely back. You can kill it. And again, I often recommend, when it comes to large trees, have a certified arborist come prune your trees. Don't attempt fate. It can be very dangerous pruning large trees.
And an arborist can also assess a tree as a hazard. So they can take a look at the location of the tree, how it's growing, what it looks like. And go ahead, I'm sorry.
If it would fall, it wouldn't hurt much. It might touch the grass a little bit.
Yeah, I would just leave it.
Connie, thank you so much for the call, and good luck to you with that tree. We're going to catch up with the latest news and come back and take calls from Jim and Armando and Mary, and your call as well. Our guest on Garden Talk are Laura Jell, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist for Woody Ornamentals in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. Brian Huddleston is a plant disease diagnostician with the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, UW-Madison and Extension. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today for some garden talk. And what better day to have a garden talk when everybody's probably sitting indoors or shoveling. But one of these days, we'll be planting trees and trimming trees and caring for them, and we'll be diagnosing plant diseases as well. It's a pleasure to have Laura Jell and Brian Huddleston with us. Again, thank you very much for being here today. Real pleasure to have you. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our topics, of course, are woody ornamentals, including the trees, shrubs, and vines, and plant diseases. And we'll go to Armando in Galena. Hello, Armando.
Hey, good afternoon, Jim and Laura. Thank you very much for your program. The question I would like to ask is, about 10 years ago, a store had some Canadian hemlock on sale, and then they're so beautiful, I bought them all, about 60, and then I planted them. It was probably like about September of 10 years ago, and now I only have like 10 left. They were all dying little by little, and then now there is one that is all yellow, and it's beautiful. It grew, but they're all dying. It is the soil here, or... I was wondering, what's the problem with the Canadian?
Galena, Illinois.
Yes, it's near Dubuque, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
It's Dubuque, Iowa. So
right.
It's in the corner of Illinois.
We know Galena well. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like your soil might be too heavy. Again, hemlocks do not like poorly drained, heavy clay soils. Do you know what type of soil you have?
I have lots of clay because they're just kind of surrounding a pond that I built, and the clay was great for the pond, but probably not good for the hemlock.
No, unfortunately, hemlocks, they really prefer a sandy loam, peat-based, organic type of soil on the acidic side as well. And unfortunately, in that part of the state, the soils aren't very conducive to growing hemlocks. It's just too heavy, poorly drained, and the pH, since this area is very heavily parent material in limestone, the pH is probably just too high as well. And hemlocks, they're just unhappy in that type of situation.
And so what kind of evergreens would you recommend that I would use for? Because but I like this just to see them in the winter too, you know, some greenery around the pond. So the ones that are, I replaced some of the ones that died early with the evergreen, what is it called, the Colorado.
Oh, blue spruce.
Yeah. They have been doing more or less well.
What you'll see with the Colorado blue spruce is that when they're small, they'll actually be a very nice tree and they'll look quite nice. It's going to be, you're going to start to have problems with those particular trees when they get large. As you get more foliage, or if you were listening earlier, we were discussing this rhizosphere disease. That tends to come into the trees when they get roughly 10 to 15 years old. And there are some other disease problems that we can see on that particular kind of conifer. But what do you suggest, Laura, in terms of that site?
Are you looking for a large tree?
Yes, okay. I like large trees so they can hide my neighbors.
two in particular that would do well in that area is one's called white spruce.
Okay.
White spruce will do well. It's native. Another one is Black Hills spruce, not black spruce. Black spruce is a northern bog species. This is Black Hills spruce.
Okay, and
Hills, yeah. And it's actually a variety of white spruce. Both of those would do very well.
Yeah, and I tend to find that I don't see a lot of serious disease problems on that type of spruce, the white spruce or the Black Hills. So they're one of the ones that I tend to recommend from a disease standpoint as well.
Yeah. And regarding pines, and I don't recommend these two pines, Scots pine and Austrian pine. Those can tolerate heavy clay, high pH soils, but they're so disease prone and insect prone that we just don't recommend them anymore.
Okay. I really appreciate your advice. Thank you very much.
All right, Armando. Thank you very much for the call. And on to Jim in Madison. Hi, Jim.
Hi. And thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
About 20 years ago, I transplanted some lilac shoots from my folks' house in Oconomowoc, and they're thriving. I mean, they're going well, but now they're sort of increasing the area, sending out lots of shoots as well. And I want to keep these lilacs healthy and going. What's the best treatment to, you know, maintain the health and longevity of the lilacs? Should I prune the shoots back occasionally, select dominant shoots, or just let it do its thing? I got the space. It can do it.
Okay. I'm not trying to pump my own publication, but I have a
lilac publication. It's a great publication.
I don't get any money for it. But anyways, I have a new publication on lilacs. It's called Lilacs for Cold Climates, and it's available at the UW Extension Publications website. It's I'm not sure if there's a www in front of it.
I think you just go to Learning Store.
Learning Store, yeah. It's learningstore.com.
UWEX.edu.
Right.
And the learning store is all one word, so it's learningstore.uwex.edu. And it's a publication, it's a new one called Lilacs for Cold Climates. And in it, I talk about all the different species of lilacs we can grow, when they flower, and how to properly prune them. And I talk about how to properly prune the various species in detail.
Okay.
When it comes to lilacs, I would not prune them now because pruning them now, you would remove some of the flower buds, and that's the whole purpose of growing lilacs. They actually set their flower buds the previous summer, and they don't obviously flower until the following spring. Though I do personally like to prune lilacs in the dormant season, and I know I'm removing some flower buds, but it's good to see the architecture of the plant and to get in there. Plus, the mosquitoes aren't out, and it's not 90 degrees.
It's really a good thing from a disease standpoint as well, because if you're pruning during the growing season, you're much more likely to have particularly fungal pathogens that will get established in the pruning cuts. So I recommend pruning during the dormant season as well.
Yeah, and another thing with lilacs, I'm not sure what species of lilacs. You probably have one of the more common lilacs.
It's an old double white, and that's all I know about it.
Yeah, it's probably one of the old common French hybrid lilacs. And with those, the larger the diameter of the branches, so those big, fat, large branches, that those need to be removed, about a third of them, on a regular basis every year. And lilac is some of the toughest wood to cut. You'll need a saw don't even attempt using loppers unless they're smaller. But we like to remove a third of the largest diameter branches all the way at the base of the plant, right where they're coming out of the ground, because it's been shown as lilac branches get older, large diameter branches, their flower production decreases. And those 2 and 3 year old shoots coming out of the ground tend to be more productive, more flower buds. Also with lilacs, as they get older, they are become more susceptible to lilac borer. And it's an insect that actually burrows into the branches towards the bottom, I'd say bottom 3 feet of the plant. And it almost looks like somebody took a shotgun to it. And you'll see holes in the actual trunk of the plant. Those larger diameter branches are more susceptible to lilac borers.
Well, I think you just made a sale on the publication. Right.
I've seen that publication. And granted, Laura and I are good friends, but that's a stunning publication. So I think you'll enjoy it if you get it.
Jim, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. On to Mary in Wanakee, the only Wanakee in the world. Hello, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I'm calling because I heard the conversation about blue spruce and thought I'd add a note here. About 3 or 4 years ago, we started noticing globular growths. I call them galls, but that not, you know, doesn't necessarily mean what they are. But they're on the north side of the tree, and it's where the branches twig out. And then as the season progresses, the twigs die back and the galls die, and then the next year they form closer to the trunk, and then the twigs die, and it's working its way back to the trunk. And I'm a little concerned about the progression of this. I don't want the tree to die on us.
Yeah, does it look like, did they initially look like little tiny pineapples at the tips of the branches?
I don't know that they were ever at the tips of the branches. Mm-hmm. They were at the confluence of the branches. Pineapples is, I don't know.
Okay.
They were just round, ugly-looking things.
Yeah, my first thought on spruce is there's a little insect gall that is formed, and oftentimes it's fairly sporadic in terms of its occurrence. Some years you'll have it, some years you won't. And typically what we recommend, we consider that, in most instances, kind of a cosmetic issue. And our typical recommendation is simply to prune out those galls to make the tree look a little bit better. If you're interested, we do have a fact sheet on those on that particular gall. It's available at our horticulture website. You might want to check that out, and you can download that or read it online. And there's a picture as well to see whether that's what you were looking at. But that's the most likely thing that I can think of gall-wise on a spruce tree.
And what's that website?
It's wihort.uex.edu. And click on the University or Wisconsin Garden Facts in the main menu, and then look under spruce gall, and it'll be on there. Yeah, sometimes if you look it up on the internet, there Cooley spruce gall is what it's sometimes called. I think our fact sheet is just called spruce gall.
And that could happen both on blue spruce and on black-heeled spruce?
I think it'll go to both of those. Yeah, mm-hmm. More commonly where I see it is on blue spruce, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Mary.
As I said, I love Colorado blue spruce, but it's on my dog of a tree list just because it has so many problems.
What are the rest of the trees on your dog list?
Well, Laura mentioned Austrian pine. Again, I love Austrian pine when it's healthy, but I never see healthy Austrian pine, so it usually looks so bad that you wish it was dead. Scott's pine can have some problems. Trying to think else. What else?
Box elder.
Box elder is definitely on there. I was the person who called in earlier about box elder. I was kind of going to joke with him that that's one tree that I don't mind when it gets verticillium wilt, because I think it's better off dead in most instances. It's a very weedy tree and not a very attractive tree in the landscape. But yeah, there are some things that I just can't recommend to folks anymore.
All right. Bill in La Crosse, let's give you a chance. Go ahead.
Hello. Merry Christmas to you guys, and Happy New Year.
Yeah, it is. It's all conifers, isn't it?
Happy Easter. Anyway, I'm a winter Texan. I came back too soon.
Yes, you did.
Hey, guys. Bill, Lauren, and Brian, thank you for the program.
Sure.
I have three questions. I'll make them real quick. Number one, I have a pear tree that's 8 to 10 years old, 5 to 6 inches in diameter in the trunk, has never blossomed. It has full sun. It is self-pollinating. Okay, that's one question. You want me to continue with the other two questions?
Sure.
Okay, the other two questions is this. I have a plum tree with the same thing. It's 5 years old, no blossoms, full sun, and it's, again, self-pollinating. And I do prune these, okay? each spring. But anyway, and the third question is on Concord grapevines. I about 12 years ago, I transplanted some shoots, canes, from Concord grapes, put them in the ground in a trench, and boom, they came up. They're nice. Now, I want to do that again to another site, and I want to know if you have a better transplant method than what I used on that.
Okay, I'm not going to comment on fruit trees or vines.
Okay.
That's not my specialty. We do have some extension specialists at UW-Madison that could potentially answer your questions.
Terrell Roper.
Or Bob Tomish.
I think those folks would be able to give you better and more specific information than either one of us can on those particular questions. So that would be my suggestion. What I would suggest that you do, where are you located? You're in La Crosse?
Actually, I live in La Crosse, but my property is in DeSoto, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I would say give the county extension office there in La Crosse a call. Joyce Selecki has been hired by the county as a hort agent in La Crosse. And I would consult with her, and then she can act as kind of a go-between to get information out of either Terrell or Bob Tomish.
All right.
And can get some information back to you. There are also some nice publications on growing fruit trees and growing grapes that are available through the Extension Publications website.
Okay.
And I would check those out as well, because those are very nice publications as well, and they'll provide you some guidance in terms of transplanting and caring for the trees that you're dealing with. And again, that's learningstore.uwex.edu.
All righty.
Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Bill, thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. Jim, I'm not sure if we're going to be able to help you or not. Go ahead. Jim?
Yeah, Jim in Cumberland.
Right.
You know, my question's about fruit trees, too, so I assume the answer is the same, and what I want to say is thanks for your program.
All right, thanks a lot. We'll have a fruit specialist on for you soon to be able to answer your question. Frank in Port Edwards, what's on your mind today?
Good day, folks. Sugar maples. I have two in my yard, which I planted for shade in about 1960. And, of course, now they're about 18, 19 dBH. I have been tapping them the last few years and making delicious maple syrup. Now, the tree in the front of the house on the west side has been visited by a pileated woodpecker that has carved out I guess a bushel and a half or more of chips, and there's now a cavity in that tree just below the point where the branches start to spread that's at least 3 feet long and at least a foot deep and 6 inches wide. So it looks to me like I'm going to have that tree removed, because that certainly is going to imperil the house in a windstorm. Now my question is, or two questions. One, the form of both of these maple trees is spreading with a lot of close crotches. And in both of them, I see decay starting now where those crotches catch water or something. So I'm kind of wondering whether the decay that I see where the pileated woodpecker has removed so much wood is most likely related to that, or is there a hazard to making syrup, to tapping the trees? And what do you do about the holes that are left?
Well, you're tapping the tree in spring, correct?
Right.
All right. I wouldn't tap the tree every year. Are you tapping it every year?
I have been.
Okay. Because that can start to weaken a tree. You're taking a lot of the structural carbohydrates away from the plant. I know, you know, many of the commercial maple trees, they do tap them every year. And obviously, they're large trees. You would never do this to a young tree. Regarding the sapsucker injury you mentioned earlier.
Well, the pileated woodpecker.
He's made a
home out of
yeah.
the tree. And regarding the holes that you have in the tree from tapping it, no, don't do anything to them. Again, putting any type of wound compound or tree paint or any type of dressing is actually bad. It retains too much moisture, and you're more prone to get decay moving into the tree, as well as slowing down wound closure.
Yeah. My practice has been to purge the hole when I'm through with a pretty strong bleach solution. And then just leave it open?
No, you don't even need to do that. I would just, you know, leave it, make sure it's a nice, clean cut, it's rounded, no jagged edges, and the plant will eventually close that wound. If you're doing a, how many holes on the tree are you doing it?
Oh, two.
Two. Okay, it's not very many. Your question was regarding the narrow crotch angles, and I'm trying to remember your
The rot that you were mentioning, that certainly could be, if you're seeing some rotting in that area where the pileated woodpecker has been, that certainly could be the same organism that's causing the rotting problems in your crotches. It's hard to tell without actually examining the wood, but that's certainly a possibility.
Now I'm going to have to replace that one in the front. What kinds of shade trees are you recommending these days?
And you are in...
In Port Edwards.
County. What county?
Port Edwards.
Yeah, Port Edwards. Wood County.
Wood County. Okay. Mm-hmm. Wood County's going up there. So, you know, again, another sugar maple. I love sugar maples. I would obviously not use it as a street tree, but as a lawn tree, it's a beautiful lawn tree. I'm not sure what your pH is, but you could plant one of the oaks. Some of our native oaks. White oak is a beautiful tree, though it does prefer slightly acid soil. You could also go with... red oak, again, slightly acid soil. I don't know what your pH is up there.
Yeah, my concern with a red oak would be a possibility of oak wilt.
Yeah, oak wilt.
Also white oak as well, but red oaks tend to be slightly more, well, they once they get the disease, it tends to kill them very, very rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Right. Swamp white oak is another nice one. I mean, any of the oaks can get oak wilt, but I still love the oaks.
Yeah, I do too.
Regarding maples, again, depending on your pH, red maple is a very nice plant as well, but it does need acid soil. You could go with Kentucky coffee tree, though that is getting kind of northern limit of that species. There's many, many different tree species you can use up there, depending on what how large of a tree you want, if you want fall color, if you want something attracting wildlife. I would stay away from ash. Because of emerald ash borer coming in, it'll eventually get here. It's right on the borderline of Wisconsin and Illinois, and it's only a matter of time. You can get them really cheap, but I don't recommend planting.
Wouldn't do it. Frank, thank you very much. We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to get a couple more callers in, if possible. And Viola in Shawano is next. Hello, Viola.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call. My problem is I have a Weigelia shrub. And I just love them because they are so pretty when they flower. And what I'd like to know is this last winter, I had stakes around it when I planted it, and it was doing really well. And then my dog got the chain around it this last winter, broke off those stakes, and kind of wrecked it. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if I could replant that someplace else.
Yes, you can replant it someplace else. You could do it before it leaves out. You know, well, obviously not today with all the snow, but you can replant it before it leaves out. Do not transplant it as it's leafing out. That's the worst possible time to move any plant. You could transplant it after it leaves out, but doing it now before it starts to leaf out is actually one of the best times to transplant.
Covered with snow right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'd wait till the snow melts. And the ground thaws.
And the ground thaws a little bit as well.
Okay. All right, Viola, thank you very much. And Judy in Grafton, it's your turn.
Okay, thank you. I have three tamarisk trees, which I planted for like a screening, privacy screen. And I am really struggling with how to prune them. You know, I want them to be full, but they just like the caller earlier with the birch, some of the limbs just really are falling on an angle.
Well, let's get an answer because we're running out of time.
Okay.
Is it tamarack or tamarisk?
No, not tamarack. It's tamarisk, the one that blossoms.
With pink flowers?
Blooms, the purple tops.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, regarding that species, I'm a little leery of using that species. It's extremely invasive out in the Colorado and in the western states. It's not been reported to be invasive here, but that's a keep watch. In terms of pruning that one, yes, they're very floppy, leggy, somewhat kind of ugly-looking plants. They don't have a good form at all. I would do selective thinning, removing some of the largest diameter branches back to the base of the plant, and encouraging sucker growth from the base. But it's one best left for the back of a border. It's a very open, airy plant, not suitable for screening.
And again, Judy, thank you so much for the call. I'm sorry we can't get to more people, but we have run out of time. Our guests on Garden Talk, Laura Jull, Associate Professor, Extension Specialist for Woody Ornamentals, UW-Madison Horticulture Department, and Brian Huddleston, Plant Disease Diagnostician with the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, UW-Madison and Extension. Laura and Brian, thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Look forward to your next visit. And I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller. He'll be back on Monday. Our thanks to Keisha Mabra for on-air phone production. And on Monday at 11, Larry will be talking about the first ever President's Fitness Challenge with John Burke, who is also the president of Trek Bicycles. Monday at 11:45, we'll do a little walleye fishing with Gary Engberg, a professional guide from Mesa Mani, Wisconsin. All coming up on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.